Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. 2012 words. That's what it took this week for Janet Yellen to tell us what she's thinking. We're going to wrap up the 5 days gone by on the program today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday, the 12th of February. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. I know I say that all the time. I actually mean it, though. All right, anyway, any week in which we hear from Janet Yellen is almost by definition a week worth talking about. Helps that a whole bunch of other stuff is going on out there as well. So here for the weekly wrap are Neela Richardson from Redfin. David Gura is from Bloomberg. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
So, Neela, we're going to start with you, and we're going to start with Janet Yellen's testimony on Capitol Hill this week to both houses of Congress. It seems to me, and this bums me out a little bit, that we are back in a place where we are hanging on her every word.
You know what? We are so at that place, yeah. Kai. Yeah. And the market really reacted during the time of Yellen's testimony to see that 300-point dip in the Dow at times during that testimony was really remarkable as she discussed the possibility of negative interest rates. It all fed back on each other that maybe the economy is not as strong as we thought as we ended the year in 2015.
Yeah. Girl, let me ask you this, just picking up on that negative interest rates point. If we're at the point where we're talking about negative interest rates with the chair of the Fed, we've pretty much come to the place where there's nothing else they can really do, right?
Yeah, we've seen other central banks do it. We saw it in Japan. We saw it in Europe. It struck me listening to her talk about that yesterday that she's clearly thought about it. Somebody asked her if she'd question the legality of it. Could she actually do it? And she said she hadn't looked into it. It was interesting watching her over the course of those 2 days. Of course, she fielded a lot of questions from representatives that had nothing to do with monetary policy. But I thought she stood pretty firm on 2 points. She was reiterative. She made the point again and again and again that the Fed is going to be make moves based on data. She said this time and time again. And for that reason, it kind of makes you want to hit yourself over the head because she keeps saying it and nobody believes her when she's saying it.
Right.
And the other thing is just they wanted her to acknowledge what's going on, acknowledge that there's been all this volatility that we've seen. Bad markets in China, that we've seen bad markets here. And she did that. She said something interesting, though. She said, I don't think it's mainly our policy that's caused it. In other words, I think there are a lot of people who believe that the Fed acted too soon. Maybe it made a mistake. She's trying to make the case that, in fact, she doesn't think that's what happened, and she's going to move slowly here going forward.
Exactly. And Neela, it's almost like she's damned if she does, damned if she doesn't, right?
Well, that is the role of the Fed chairman during a volatile time.
Right.
I mean, there's no right answer. There's only just trying to get the right data to tell you the story of what to do. Look, we have a lot of things going on. We have China, and there's a lot of volatility due to the slowing growth of that country. We have very low oil prices, and what does that mean to the American consumer? And we have this low inflation environment and the specter of a recession. So there's nothing good that the Fed chairman can say to alleviate markets at this time. The only thing they can say is we're data dependent. There are no preset courses and our path is uncertain, which is as good as we're going to get.
David, if you are out there in Sheboygan, you know, reading the news every day and you see all this volatility, what do you suppose people are making of it?
It's hard. You know, I talked to an asset manager today, manages a lot of money in the trillions, and he said the tendency here is to be bearish and to worry about this. And it's hard to sort of swallow and think, you know, this is going to be all right in the long term. Things work in cycles. But, I mean, you look at volatility in oil prices. We hit a 12-year low yesterday. Yep. We were up again today. You look at the S&P 500. We had more 20-point swings in the past month than we've had in 7.5 years. So there's all this noise. It's feeding this feedback loop that's there. Sentiment is something we have to deal with. So there's this debate over technicals and fundamentals, but it has to do with psyche.
It's all about how
and it's
feel.
Hard to exactly. It's hard to reckon with that.
Exactly.
And once again, we're seeing this disconnect between the stock market reaction and what we're seeing with the consumer, which is, you know, still a decent labor market, still growing, even though the economy slowed in the fourth quarter. We're seeing retail sales that are decent.
Yep.
We're seeing a pickup in labor force participation, some evidence that the labor market is tightening and we might get some wage growth. So there are some good things going on in the real economy that the markets like to ignore because they're really focused on what's going on abroad.
All right. So, Neela, with that as preface, and we've got like 30 seconds left to split between the two of you, I asked Cardiff and Catherine this 2 weeks ago. I asked Lee and Sudeep a week ago. All four of them poo-pooed me. I want you guys to each weigh in on the prospect of a recession coming down the pike. David, you go first. And seriously, like 15 seconds.
You know, people are telling me that the markets are pricing that in. But as Neela was just saying, you've got all of these economic indicators that show you that the economy, the U.S. economy, is actually doing all right in a lot of ways. I mean, look at the labor market. That's at 4.9% unemployment now. You've got some wage growth. So it seems like the markets are saying one thing, the economy is saying another.
Neela, up to you. 15. Go.
Recession is unlikely, but the slow growth environment, I think, is here to stay for a really long time.
Hmm. All right. Neela Richardson from Redfin, David Gura from Bloomberg. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you, Kai.
Have a nice weekend, everybody. The big banks led the charge on Wall Street today, the biggest of them right out front with some help from its CEO. The Wall Street Journal reported this morning that J.P. Morgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon spent $26 million worth of his own money to buy 500,000 shares of JPM stock. Got a pretty good bargain, too, Mr. Dimon did. The company shares yesterday, when he is said to have bought them, were off 20% from where they were just 6 months ago. Rest of Wall Street had a rip-roaring day. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Neela was just talking about this a minute ago. Figures out this morning from the Commerce Department show Americans spent a bit more freely in January than we did the month before. Retail sales up 0.2%, better than anybody had been guessing, driven mostly by spending on cars, clothing, and shopping online. It comes, of course, after Janet Yellen had some less than sunny things to say about the state of the American economy. So we asked Marketplace's Kimberly Adams to put today's numbers in context and also how they might figure into what Janet Yellen is thinking.
So congrats. Retail sales beat expectations. But Raymond Hill of Emory's Guazzetta Business School is unimpressed with today's numbers.
They weren't bad, but they weren't outstanding either.
Which may as well be a motto for the current economy. Hill says lower oil prices should technically boost retail, but
there's no way to disentangle the negative effect of slow overall growth and uncertainty from the positive effect that consumers have more money in their pocket because of lower energy costs.
Money people weren't willing to spend last year. Dennis Hoffman teaches business at Arizona State University. He says consumers will probably come around since it looks like gas prices are going to stay low. But a boost in retail sales won't be enough to convince the Fed the economy is firmly back on track.
So what are they going to be watching is primarily labor market pressures, price pressures, another round of retail sales data, another employment report, and they're going to be looking at those closely.
Which is basically what Chair Yellen told Congress. Peter Conte Brown is a Fed expert at the Wharton School of Business. He says it will take something major to divert the Fed from its strategy of incremental increases to the interest rate. But we don't know what those increments are yet.
So have we seen all the increases that we are going to see in 2016, which is none? That Yellen didn't say, because I suspect Yellen does not know.
But she'll have plenty of data to go through between now and the next Fed meeting in March to help figure it out. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Plenty of stocks have taken a pounding this year and then bounced back and then gotten pounded again and bounced back. But for Pandora, the internet radio giant, it's been all pounding. Precious little bounce back. Shares were down 12% today, off by nearly two-thirds since last fall. And now there's news the company that pretty much introduced us to the business of music streaming may be on the auction block. Marketplace's Adrian Hill has that story.
Pandora has a problem. We live in an on-demand world. And when I want the song Bad Day for this story, 'cause you had a bad day, I can instantly get it on Spotify or Apple Music. But on Pandora, I can't pick. I get a song that sounds similar to Bad Day. But it's not Bad Day. Eric Gordon from the University of Michigan's Ross School of Business says Pandora runs the risk of becoming the latest stumbling pioneer.
The idea that the pioneer blazes the trail and then falls to the wayside, it's just been repeated over and over again.
MySpace cut the path for Facebook. Yahoo was introduced years before Google. The list goes on.
Sometimes you lock yourself into a business model that's hard to escape from, and it's not the winning business model.
Pandora works a little like commercial radio. It's free for most listeners and comes with ads, and it has around 80 million users, way more than the other guys, but it's not making enough money off of them.
Pandora is struggling with the fact that there is incredible amount of competition in digital music.
Richard Greenfield is a media and tech analyst at BTIG.
And there's now lots of companies entering the space who don't need to make money in music alone. Take companies like Apple or Google.
So who'd want to buy Pandora?
You know, hashtag good luck Pandora.
But analyst Rich Tulo from Albert Fried is more optimistic.
You know, it's a wide net that would be interested in Pandora.
From traditional media companies, he says, like CBS with experience in radio, to the less expected, like Netflix, looking for something new to offer subscribers. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Crude oil today, as Gura was mentioning, and holy cow, we talked about a lot of stuff up in that wrap. Anyway, holy cow, up 12% today oil was, the biggest single-day jump in 7 years, almost back at $30 a barrel. The caveat here, of course, is that not all that long ago, the price of a barrel of oil was well above $100 a whack. And with prices so relatively low, there's a lot of attention being focused on the big oil producers. We did Venezuela yesterday. Today, Saudi Arabia. It is by far the dominant member of OPEC. And of all the reasons that oil prices fell, perhaps the biggest was OPEC's call in late 2014 to keep on pumping flat out and oversupply the market. Why'd they do it? And did it work? Marketplace's Scott Tong.
One word that crops up a lot with Saudi Arabia is opaque. The leaders of the kingdom tend not to share their thinking too widely. But the consensus in the oil markets is the Saudis led OPEC's decision to flood the oil market in 2014, to keep pumping and send the price crashing. Why? Well, Mideast energy consultant Sarah Vakhshouri says a price war sinks rival producers, especially high-cost producers like fracking companies. They drill in shale rock in America, and they want to go global.
The low oil prices really kept the shale revolution a U.S. phenomenon rather than expanding it to countries like China.
And Vakhshouri says the move to cut prices keeps the car drivers of the world addicted to petroleum rather than trying alternatives.
The low oil prices could slightly push global demand high. It, of course, makes it harder for renewables to progress as fast as they were doing.
So think of the Saudis as the Walmart, the Southwest heir of crude oil. Low cost, deep pockets. But even in the monarchy, the money's not forever. Not at prices one-third of what they were a couple years back. Mark Lynch directs the project on Middle East political science at George Washington University.
Saudi Arabia has huge reserves financially. They can get away for several years with running huge budget deficits. It's not that they're in an immediate crisis, but looking towards the longer term, it does become unsustainable, even for Saudi Arabia.
If crude prices stay low, the International Monetary Fund figures Riyadh could burn up its savings in just 5 years. Here's the issue. Saudi Arabia spends a lot right now on subsidies at home, on Sunni mosques and schools across the Middle East, and more.
They made a whole bunch of commitments at a time when oil was very expensive, and now they suddenly find themselves forced to continue to pay out at a time when the price of oil has really plummeted.
So now comes austerity. The government has doubled the price of gasoline at home, and it cuts subsidies for electricity in a hot desert country where people are known to blast the AC at home, even when they're out. Politically, it's a risky play for leaders who happen to be new. Last year brought a new king and a new deputy crown prince. Here's Middle East consultant Jean-Francois Sesnick.
The second generation, the young guys, if you like, are taking over. The young prince, who is so criticized for being a hothead and so on, he's really in charge of modernizing the economy.
And in charge of defense spending. The Saudis are bankrolling a war against militants next door in Yemen. It's not going so well. And they support rebels in Syria. That's not going so well. Sesnik says what ties all this together is an attempt to counter a rising Iran in the region. It's a longtime rival of the Saudis.
To this day, I think there's a fear in the Saudi leadership that the Iranians are, you know, basically taking over Iraq, have taken over Syria, etc., etc.
And Iran just reached a nuclear sanctions deal with the United States, a longtime ally of Saudi Arabia. And today, the U.S. pumps more of its own oil than ever. So is American support for the Saudis waning?
It may not be a fact. I'm not saying that the U.S. is moving out, but I'm saying the perception by the Saudis is that the U.S. has lost interest.
And in the end, much of the kingdom's interest comes back to oil. The rival Saudis and Iranians are members of OPEC. And if they can't get along, it's less likely OPEC will agree to intervene and bring oil prices back up. And so the global price route goes on. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up,
the 1920s really begins the golden age of medicine.
Downton Abbey and the modern healthcare economy. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 313 points today, 2%, closed at 15,973. The NASDAQ up 70 points, 1 2/3%, 4,337. The S&P 500 up 35 points, about 1.9%. Ended things at 1864. For the week, the Dow dropped 1.4%. The NASDAQ off 0.6%. The S&P 500 gave back 0.8%. J.P. Morgan Chase up more than 8% today after that Jamie Dimon thing I told you about. Citigroup and Bank of America both up more than 7%. In energy, ConocoPhillips and Chevron both gained about 3%. ExxonMobil up 1.8%. Hey, look at there. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.74%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. The financial crisis and the Great Recession that followed were terrible, yes. But it seems we can't get enough of them. First up was a string of documentary films laying out exactly what happened. Now, from The Big Short to The Wolf of Wall Street and a whole lot in between, Hollywood has been doing a booming business in financial disaster movies. Alessandra Stanley from The New York Times wrote about this phenomenon not too long ago. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
We have made that transition, it seems, from documentaries about the financial crisis to dramas and fictionalization. Why have we now decided it's okay to talk about this in a different way?
Well, I think it turns out that it takes some time. I think it was such a blow to the world and to the United States that I think it does take a while. If you remember, you know, Vietnam.
Yeah.
It took a couple of years for the big movies to come out. It didn't mean that movies weren't being made, but they just were not the same ones that we remember. It's the same with the Depression. And I think it took 4 or 5 years for creators to sort of absorb it and for audiences to accept it.
Do you think in some ways, and I'm thinking now specifically of The Big Short, which has had such great success and is in a lot of ways an explainer, do you think we now want to sort of understand what happened as opposed to just having the documentarians tell us what happened?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think we want it dramatized. And I think if there's this movie that George Clooney is in, I have no idea if it's any good. But the whole point is that a normal guy holds this TV host, Jim Cramer-like TV host, at gunpoint and demands an explanation. And, of course, it's a sexier conspiracy than the ones that actually happened. But nevertheless, you know, that's the thing, is that people kind of know the language and they kind of want to understand what happened.
I wonder, though, if we're worried that this could happen again, right? And now we're sort of, I don't know, inoculating ourselves?
Well, the makers of The Big Short are, because they end the film with a warning that, I've forgotten what it's called. It's something like a bespoke tranche opportunity.
Right, exactly.
And they're thinking that that's the next version of what happened before.
What's coming down the pike? Because there are more besides just Money Monster, which is the Clooney-Jim Cramer thing.
Yeah, there's all these projects sort of in development that are about, you know, that they're about the 2008 crisis because they're named things like Smoke and Mirrors and All We Had. And my favorite one is Straight to Hell. Reese Witherspoon wants to do a kind of Legally Blonde comic movie about this, but the character she plays is fighting sexism on one hand, but she's also selling, you know, mortgage-backed securities on the other. So it'll just be interesting to see how, once people start inventing the story themselves, you know, in what direction it goes.
Alessandra Stanley writes for the New York Times. Alessandra, thanks very much.
You bet. Thank you.
I'm just going to go ahead and say this. You all can think of me what you will. I watch Downton Abbey, and I like it. There. Now you know. The show is in its last season this year, set in 1925, and there's a plotline that could have been ripped from the headlines of today. A heated debate about hospital consolidation, and a debate that turns out it's historically accurate. Jenny Gold from Kaiser Health News has the story.
If you're not a Downton fan, and even if you are, a quick plot recap. It's 1925 at Downton Abbey. Think flapper dresses and cocktail parties. And a big hospital in the nearby city of York is making a play to take over the tiny Downton Cottage Hospital. Violet, the Dowager Countess of Grantham, has a rather strong opinion on the matter.
The fact is that the Royal Yorkshire County Hospital wants to take over our little hospital, which is outrageous.
The 1920s really begins the golden age of medicine.
That's healthcare historian Howard Markel, who runs the Center for the History of Medicine at the University of Michigan. He says early 20th century hospitals didn't really have much to offer. They were pretty much 8 to 10 bed open wards. But soon, all sorts of new technologies came on the scene.
So you need X-ray machines of all kinds, you need a chemistry laboratory, you need blood banking laboratories, and you need special operating rooms.
And those cost money. So cities started to build bigger, grander hospitals, and those started to absorb the smaller, less modern hospitals around them, which did have some benefits, as Lord Merton from Downton Abbey points out.
If we form such a partnership, our patients would have access to more modern equipment, to more advanced treatments.
The situation is not all that different from what's going on today. Kathy McDonald directs the Stanford University Center for Health Policy.
I think it's been since about 2010 that there's been sort of an uptick in terms of consolidations. There's different forms of consolidations. There's, you know, hospitals acquiring hospitals. There's hospitals looking to be acquired. There's different types of alliances that happen. And there's, in terms of like how many there are, there's, I think, about 100 a year right now.
That's twice what it was before. But this time around, it's not about technology. It's about finances. Hospitals are starting to get paid based on the quality and efficiency of the care they provide instead of the quantity. Actually, tracking that quality turns out to be really expensive for hospitals. So bigger hospitals are starting to hoover up the small ones so they can do it as a group. So the debates continue, now as then. And true to form, the indomitable Maggie Smith, as the Dowager Countess, tells us exactly what she thinks about all this so-called progress.
For years, I've watched governments take control of our lives, and their argument is always the same. Fewer costs, greater efficiency, but the result is the same too. Less control by the people, more control by the state.
So whose side are the experts on in this Downton debate? Here's Markel.
Personally, I love Maggie Smith and have loved her since I was a young boy. So I'm on her side as a fan.
But he adds, the other side is probably right. MacDonald agrees. Still, it's hard to argue against the Dowager Countess.
No, she's firm. She knows. I agree. You can't argue against her.
There are plenty of Downton fans who say the whole hospital plot line is kind of a snoozer. Maybe no surprise, healthcare policy wonks love it. I'm Jenny Gold for Kaiser Health News and Marketplace.
These final notes on the way out today, two of them. First of all, that hospital plot line, totally a snoozer, totally. Number two, a quick follow-up to that thing about Beyoncé and Red Lobster from the new single she dropped just before her Super Bowl halftime show. The thing about a trip to Red Lobster being her reward for good, you know, sex. The restaurant said sales last Sunday were up 33% from a year ago. Now they're offering T-shirts that say lobster worthy. I'm shocked. Shocked. Side note here, you know who I feel bad for out of this whole thing, the whole Super Bowl halftime show thing? Chris Martin and Coldplay. That's who. All right, we got to go. At the end of a tumultuous week, the Dow finished up like this, up 213 points, 2%. The NASDAQ gained 70 points, 1 2/3%. The S&P 500 up 35 points, about 1.9%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitara Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm Kai Rizal. We are back on Monday. Have a good weekend out there, everybody. All right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.